Sports Talk Chicago is now on the air. This is John Zaglul. I'll be your host for the next hour, and today we're giving you a complete recap of the Super Bowl. Going to talk winners, losers, why the game was won, how the Patriots ended up pulling it off. We'll also analyze the NFL seasonal award winners coming up after the Super Bowl. At around 9:30, we'll be welcoming on a very special guest to talk about UChicago sports. And later in the show, we'll also talk about the Bulls, their acquisition of Carmelo Anthony, and Zach LaVine's comments. But first, let's take care of a little housekeeping. You're listening to 88.5 WHBK-FM Chicago. You can reach me personally on Twitter at John Z Sports, Instagram at John Zags, and Facebook at John Zaglul, or you can visit us at SportsTalkChicago.com. All music that you hear today on this show is produced and performed by TMMRW, and he's on all music platforms, including Spotify and iTunes. Make sure to check him out if you like what you've heard. And most importantly, give me a call. If you have any thoughts on the Super Bowl, what happened yesterday? 773-702-8424. Again, that's 773-702-8424. We'll put you right on the air and get your thoughts. But first, let me start with this. There are a number of things that annoy me in this world, but the key is I deal with them. I mean, for example, I don't find it enjoyable when my data slows down on my phone, but instead of complaining about it, I find some Wi-Fi and make sure that my data connection is restored. I also don't find it funny when I'm trying to go home for the weekend and there's traffic backed up in the Stevenson for miles. I can't get home. I'm stuck in traffic. But despite that, I wait it out, maybe put on some music, make a few phone calls, get some work done, and I deal with it. That's the key. Dealing with disappointment, dealing with problems, dealing with annoyances. But here's my problem. There are some things in life that I just can't deal with. And more importantly, I just can't understand. It's like I'm unable to process what I'm seeing. And to me, that makes it all the more disturbing and disgusting. By the way, disturbing and disgusting are two great words to describe last night's Super Bowl, in which the Patriots beat the Rams in an uncharacteristically low-scoring game with a final of 13-3. Look, I'm not annoyed by the Rams' missed opportunities. I'm not even annoyed by the fact that the Rams barely used Todd Gurley without an apparent reason behind it. Although that didn't make any sense, and we'll get to that later on in just a few minutes. What truly annoys me is the fact that once again, the Patriots did it. And once again, we'll be hearing about this repeated Tom Brady and Bill Belichick narrative until the new NFL season begins in September. That's what's annoying about this. That's my pet peeve about this entire situation. I get that this coaching and quarterback duo is one of the all-time greats. I get that I have witnessed a dynasty and history rolled into one. But my message is this. I'm sick and tired of hearing about it. I don't care about this being Tom Brady's sixth title. I don't care about the countless books that have been written about Brady and Belichick's dynastic relationship. Because in the end, it's one system based on the success of only two people. Because without one or the other, I guarantee you, the Patriots would be the laughingstocks of the NFL once again. You have to remember, before Brady and Belichick came along, this Patriots team was nothing. All they were known for was making the Super Bowl in 85, a year in which the Bears absolutely annihilated them in the Super Bowl itself, in Super Bowl 20. Yet now, we're sitting here talking about, oh, they're a dynasty. Oh, this and that. Well, you know what? I'm sick of hearing about it. Their team, this past season especially, was average. Even a bit underachieving, some might say. I mean, their best receiver was Julian Edelman. And although he had a good game last night, and he's a Super Bowl MVP, we're going to sit here and celebrate. He's just a system-wide receiver who decided to finally show up this season. Keep in mind, Edelman, which no one wants to talk about, of course, is near the top of the league in the regular season in drop passes. He had 8 drops this year. League leader was 12 in Jarvis Landry. Julian Edelman in third place with eight, tied for third. And now we're turning around and rewarding him with a Super Bowl MVP. And better yet, this is the best thing I've heard. People are saying that he belongs in Canton, in the Hall of Fame. You kidding me? Julian Edelman? Then you've got a defense that once again didn't show up until the AFC Championship game. All season long, they couldn't defend the pass. 22nd in the league in total passing defense, the Patriots. And their run defense just made it to the top 10. Yet somehow, they showed up in the Super Bowl. Which, that's annoying as well. And Tom Brady himself even had a down year. He threw 11 picks this season, the most for him in a year since 2013. And for the first time since 2014, his passer rating fell under 100. Again, I ask you this. Knowing what you know about the Patriots season, knowing what you know about the various problems along the way, are you ready to then turn around and tell me that they're truly the best team in football? Because I'm sure as hell not. I feel that Jared Goff and the Rams helped the Patriots win more than the team did to itself. Goff threw a crucial interception, completed one pass all game on third down situations. His completion percentage overall, only 50%, and had no touchdowns. I said last week that if anything, Jared Goff was going to make or break this game. And since he's posted a passer rating under 83, six of his past nine games, I knew that the Super Bowl would be a game that Goff either won or lost, not the Patriots. It'd be Jared Goff's game to win. Or Jared Goff's game to lose, which is what happened. And tell me that I'm wrong. If Goff had shown up, or more importantly, had another quarterback like Drew Brees, for example, had been facing the Patriots, this game would have ended differently. Completely different outcome had you had a better quarterback in there, instead of Jared Goff, who, in my eyes, is still a draft bust. As for the game itself, going into the actual nitty-gritty of the game, it started off much like this season for the Patriots. Rocky and uncertain. Tom Brady threw an interception, the first time in his postseason career that he's thrown a pick on a first pass of a game in the postseason. Never happened before, it happened last night. The Patriots used two timeouts in the first quarter. They weren't on the same page on offense, and on play calling, they had to burn two timeouts. And Steven Gostkowski, usually a reliable kicker, a guy who's also going to be a free agent this year, hint, hint to the Bears, he missed a 48-yard field goal. Unfortunately, however, despite all of that uncertainty, the key point that I think people are failing to realize is that the Rams failed to take advantage. That's the big story of the game, not Brady's six championships. The Rams had intercepted Tom Brady, and they went three and out. The Rams had forced Gostkowski to miss a kick. They went three and out again. And that was the theme of the entire game. Every time the Rams had an opportunity or a chance downfield, they went three and out, punted the football. And I'll bring this up again. I'll beat it into you because it's the truth. Jared Goff recorded only one completion on third down throughout the entire game. You're not going to win with that type of output. No way. And since the offense couldn't get anything going, the Rams' defense was forced to stay out on the field too long. That's when Sony Michel and Rex Burkhead ran free and pulled off those 19, 20, 25-yard gains. Michelle, in fact, scored the only touchdown of the game. And Julian Edelman, the Super Bowl MVP, caught 10 passes for 141 yards. Edelman, a known cheater, suspended for four games this year, the start of the year, due to PEDs. He finished top 10 in the league, as I mentioned, in drops. And as far as Edelman's performance goes, people are saying, now he should be in the Hall of Fame. No, no, no. This was a fluke of a performance. It'll never happen again. Here's the best quote that I heard all night about Edelman, coming from Adam Schefter of ESPN. Quote, as the MVP of this year's Super Bowl, Patriots wide receiver Julian Edelman is playing himself into a spot in Canton in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Now, without a doubt, that's the most ridiculous idea I've ever heard in my life. How can Julian Edelman, a guy with less than 6,000 career receiving yards to his name, a guy with his 33rd birthday knocking at his door, be even close to being considered one of the greatest football players of all time? That logic is extremely flawed. It's Patriots bias, and I want nothing to do with it. How about this? If it wasn't for Tom Brady, Julian Edelman wouldn't even be in the NFL anymore. I mean, who would take a chance, because I sure as hell wouldn't, on a 33-year-old wide receiver, one who just served a suspension for PEDs, and one who has recorded only 2 seasons of 1,000-plus receiving yards? See, when you look at it that way, and you look at Julian Edelman for what he really is, you'll realize that he himself is just another system player, another journeyman. He's done nothing spectacular in the NFL. Nothing noteworthy. A PED suspension to his name. Less than 6,000 receiving yards to his name. 33 years old. Only 2 years out of 8 of 1,000-plus receiving yards. See, when you look at it that way, you'll realize, man, this guy kind of sucks. Or, this guy had a great game last night, but based on his past, it's very surprising. So let's put it all together now. Let's sum up what we've talked about so far. The Patriots won the Super Bowl yesterday with an aging quarterback, an otherwise mediocre wide receiver, all while playing one of the worst and most overworked team defenses in the NFL. Look, you can celebrate all you want. You can revel in the fact that the Patriots and Tom Brady have won their 6th Super Bowl. But you won't make a convert out of me. And I'll always contend that the Patriots should be thanking Jared Goff and the overworked Rams defense for their victory, not the average, sometimes mediocre talent surrounding Tom Brady. And online, I posted a question to my Facebook group. You can still comment on it right now. I'll read some more comments if they come in throughout the show. I said, quote, the Patriots did not necessarily win the game as much as the Rams lost it. And I said, hey, give me a comment. Tell me what you think of that statement. So here are a couple of comments. This one from Daniel. The Pats wore the Rams down and the Pats D was locked down. The Pats earned it. That's one way of thinking about it. I don't know if they earned it, though, because you didn't mention anything about Jared Goff and his performance, which was horrible. So I get that idea that the Pats earned it. Maybe they did somewhat. I mean, obviously they had to go out there and beat a team like the Rams, but at the same time, if you're telling me that the Rams did nothing to contribute to their own demise, if you're telling me that the Rams did nothing to play a role in their own loss, then you're crazy. Another comment from Christian. The moment was too big for Goff. Gurley was a non-factor, even though they kept saying the knee was not hindering him. Overall, I'd say the Patriots still had to win the game, but the Rams certainly didn't help their cause. Thank you. Thank you for that comment. That is extremely accurate. The Patriots had to win the game. They had to beat the Rams, and of course they did. But the Rams did nothing to help themselves. Jared Goff did nothing to help himself. Todd Gurley was quote-unquote being rested or was injured. Nobody knows the true story there. And then one more comment from Bob. Honestly, well, I had no interest in the game for many reasons. No elaboration. But obviously, no interest in the game. And hey, that's a fair sentiment. There are a lot of people that I saw on Twitter say this was a forgettable Super Bowl overall, and the ratings will probably be down. I don't know if that's because of the lack of scoring. Personally, as a true fan of football, I enjoyed the game. I enjoyed the defensive battle. But if you're a casual fan, I can understand why you didn't like it. It's a very low-scoring game. Lots of punting. It was a field position battle. And if you're not a true X's and O's person, if you're not a true football fan and you can't appreciate that, then I can see why the Super Bowl didn't live up to your standards. But for me, I enjoyed the game. I just didn't like the result. And finally, I wanted to talk about last week, my predictions as far as the betting odds, the point spread. The Patriots entered as 2.5 points favorites. So they covered the spread. My prediction as far as the score was wrong, I said 28-24. It was 13-3. But I did say that it would be sure as heck under 56.5 points, and I'm going to stand by that. Man, only 16 combined points between both teams. If you chose the under last night, you made out like a bandit. So, again, my betting advice here on this show last week was correct throughout. So, very interesting. If you listened in and you took my advice, I hope you ended up winning some money, because it ended up working out for the best. But again, as for the Super Bowl, congrats to the Patriots. I mean, you won. But realize that you won more so because the Rams lost. And the Rams blew it themselves. They beat themselves. Rather than you guys actually earning the victory. And I think that's the moral of last night's Super Bowl in Atlanta. It might be the door alarm or the new safety drain covers, the pool fencing, even the swim lessons. But the fact is, you can never know which safety step will save a life until it does. Adding multiple safety steps to your safe pool practices can mean the difference between a close call and a call to 911. Simple steps save lives. To learn some new ones, visit poolsafety.gov. So we just finished up talking about the Super Bowl. Patriots win, unfortunately. And before we welcome on our guest, and we have STC Flashback 2 coming up, I want to recap for a minute the award winners that were revealed Saturday night. Talk about who's truly deserving. Did the voters get it right? And we'll start with Offensive Rookie of the Year and Saquon Barkley. Now, I will say this. No one is more deserving of that award than Barkley himself. For starters, none of the quarterbacks who were drafted in this year's draft class made an impact this year on their respective teams. I mean, the only one I could think of is Lamar Jackson, and even though he led the Ravens to the playoffs, didn't do anything. His total stats were nothing to necessarily be proud of. I mean, 1,200 passing yards in 7 games is nothing. It's averaging like 150 a game. So when you eliminate all the quarterbacks, eliminate Lamar Jackson, came down to dynamic running backs, Barkley, Philip Lindsay, Nick Chubb. But when picking from that group, although Lindsay and Chubb had great years, don't get me wrong, I was very happy with what they put up. I think the important thing is that Saquon Barkley ran away with this award. He ran for 1,300 yards, averaged 5 yards a carry, recorded 11 rushing touchdowns, caught 91 passes for 721 yards. Also, he led the league in scrimmage yards with 2,028. There isn't a rookie out there that could compare to those numbers. And even if a rookie quarterback did well, it'd be difficult to disown what Barkley's done for his team. Easy choice. Very happy with the fact that Barkley's the Offensive Rookie of the Year. Now for the Defensive Rookie of the Year, Darius Leonard. Think about this. He was a second-round draft pick, known to have lots of potential. He wins a starting linebacker spot out of training camp, and things materialized very quickly. He made headlines immediately. He recorded 19 total tackles in Week 2, and his dominance didn't end there. Recorded double-digit tackles in 9 games throughout the season, including a streak of three consecutive. By season's end, he became one of the main reasons as to why the Colts made it to the playoffs. He ended up leading all of football in total tackles, total solo tackles. And if it wasn't for Aaron Donald's 20 and a half sacks, we could be talking about Darius Leonard as the defensive player of the year. But for now, Leonard deserves this award, and I'm very excited to see what he can bring to the future for this Colts team. Comeback player of the year now, Andrew Luck, another Colts player, another deserving player of this award. And the main argument was Andrew Luck or J.J. Watt, one of the two. Now look, I'm not trying to take anything away from what Watt accomplished. He recorded 16 sacks, led the NFL in forced fumbles with 7 after missing the majority of 2017. But think about this. Andrew Luck hasn't played a snap since 2017. And in fact, there were talks that he'd never step onto an NFL field again. So, judging strictly upon situation and fear around even coming back, Andrew Luck wins that battle. And for performance, Luck led his team from a 1-5 start to a 10-6 finish, playoff appearance for the first time since 2014, and he set career highs in passing yards, completion percentage, passer rating. Knowing that Luck had the best year of his career after missing an entire season, knowing that Luck was feared to never step on the field again, I mean, that makes the claim to this honor right there. How can you not give it to someone who had the best year of his career coming off of a career-threatening injury? You can't make an argument there. And even though Watt did well, Luck was way more valuable to his team. I mean, he led them to the playoffs. They hadn't made it in three consecutive seasons, and ironically enough, in those past 3 years, Luck had missed one game or more. So again, it goes to show you how much he means to his team, and he's deserving of the Comeback Player of the Year award. Four more awards left. Offensive Player of the Year, Patrick Mahomes the winner. Candidly speaking, I don't necessarily agree with this decision. I feel that Mahomes, he won the MVP, and that's right, but he isn't necessarily the most dynamic, the best offensive player in the league. I mean, think about it. Todd Gurley had an impressive season. Rushed for 1,250 yards, 17 touchdowns. Saquon Barkley, 1,300 yards, 11 touchdowns, league lead in scrimmage yards. So again, there are multiple other players who have worthy claims to this honor. And even though Mahomes had the 5,000 yards, I get it, the 50 touchdowns, yes. Let's not forget about the weapons around him. Tyreek Hill and Sammy Watkins, his wide receivers, at his disposal. Travis Kelce was his tight end. And heck, Andy Reid was his coach. One of the greatest offensive minds in the game today. So I feel that both Gurley and Barkley are much more deserving of this honor rather than Patrick Mahomes. Now to Defensive Player of the Year, Aaron Donald. No problem with this choice. They got this one right. How can you argue with 20 and a half sacks and 25 tackles for a loss, both league highs? And to think, the Rams were willing to let him go. They weren't willing to pay him. There was a contract dispute all offseason with him. That would have been a mistake. Donald is most arguably the best defensive player of this era, let alone this past season. And even though Khalil Mack deserved consideration, and in any other season, I'd say Khalil Mack would win the award. Again, you can't argue with 20 and a half sacks and how much the Rams benefited from having him on defense. And I'll tell you what, if Donald could put together 3-4 more seasons like this, he's destined for Canton, no doubt about it. Donald was more than deserving of this Defensive Player of the Year award. I have no problem with him earning it. Now to NFL Coach of the Year, Matt Nagy. Another choice I'm ecstatic about. Imagine this. Imagine this scenario. You've been thriving under the direction of Andy Reid, one of the greatest offensive minds in football history. You're selected to become the next head coach of the Chicago Bears, a team with a storied history, yet also a team that hasn't made the playoffs in 8 years, and hadn't posted a winning record in six. That's not a task that many people would be willing to do, let alone succeeding in turning the franchise around in 1 year. But that's what Matt Nagy did. He injected this franchise with a breath of fresh air, a new winning culture. He greatly helped Mitchell Trubisky develop in his second season. And he led the team to 12 wins for the first time since 2006, when the Bears won 13 games and made it to the Super Bowl. Matt Nagy did an unexpectedly outstanding job this past season. And this award embodies all of the hard work and dedication that he's put forth for this franchise. A congrats to the most deserving NFL Coach of the Year. So with Nagy winning Coach of the Year, let's go now to the final award that we're going to get to, the NFL MVP. That's Patrick Mahomes. And although I don't approve of him winning Offensive Player of the Year, I do approve of Patrick Mahomes winning the NFL MVP award, and here's why. We saw what the Chiefs were under Alex Smith, and this is no knock on Alex Smith, actually one of my favorite quarterbacks in the game, but this is what they did under Alex Smith. They consistently won 10 or 11 games, they always made the playoffs, yet they had never won a playoff game, and had never advanced to an AFC championship. The franchise was good, they were good, but they were stagnant, and couldn't get past the first round of the playoffs. But now, under Patrick Mahomes, they made it to their first AFC championship game since 1994, and are firmly on the map as a serious Super Bowl contender. Actually, the odds just came out today, the Chiefs are the favorite for next year's Super Bowl championship. Talk about taking your game to the next level. Talk about ending a period of stagnant growth and entering a new era of explosive potential. That's what Patrick Mahomes did for the Chiefs this year. And of course, you can't argue with 5,000 plus passing yards, 50 touchdowns, passer rating of 114. Despite the weapons that he had around him, and believe you me, he had lots of weapons, I'm not going to deny it, Patrick Mahomes did do the most for his team, and I'm happy with his MVP distinction. So again, going through the awards, Saquon Barkley, Offensive Rookie of the Year, Defensive Rookie of the Year, Darius Leonard, Comeback Player of the Year, Andrew Luck, Offensive Player of the Year, Patrick Mahomes, Defensive Player of the Year, Aaron Donald, Coach of the Year, Matt Nagy, and NFL MVP, Patrick Mahomes, most of which I agree with. And it's nice to see all those guys rack up those awards as the season ends. So at this time, we're going to get to our Sports Talk Chicago flashback with Len Casper, TV voice of the Chicago Cubs. We took a look back at the Cubs' 2018 season, we prepared for 2019, and Len gave some significant analysis on the Cubs and their role so far this offseason. We'll play the interview right when we come back. Coach John Fitzgerald of UChicago will be calling in for an interview. We'll talk about UChicago basketball and baseball, and also have a candid conversation about the direction of Major League Baseball. So again, lots to talk about. Listen to the interview with Len Casper. I think you'll enjoy it. And when we come back, John Fitzgerald live here on Sports Talk Chicago. Well, to start today, Len, let's quickly recap the Cubs' 2018 season. Now, they won 95 games, the second best record in the NL, but they ended up having to play in the wild card game where they lost to Colorado. So obviously, it was an odd season based on the record and the way things ended. What's your take on the 2018 season for the Cubs?
I think it's a little bit of both. It can't really be a failure when you win 95 games, but it's a failure when you're a team that had been to the NLCS the previous three consecutive seasons, and you get bounced in the one-game wild card. If they had won one more game along the way, they would have not only not played in the wild card game, but they would have been sitting around waiting to host the winner of that game, and have had a home field advantage throughout the National League playoffs, which is what happened to the Milwaukee Brewers. You give the Brewers a lot of credit. The Cubs actually were over 500 in September, but it was the Milwaukee surge late that kind of tipped it for the Brewers. And I just give them all the credit. By the end of the season, they were the best team in the league, and You know, they end up going seven games against the Dodgers, who end up beating them to get to the World Series. But in the end, I think it hurts to have to tip your cap to a division rival. But in the end, the Brewers were just a little bit better.
Len Kasper here on Sports Talk Chicago. And Len, coming into the 2019 season, the Cubs had made some minor moves during the offseason, signing Daniel Descalso and recently Brad Brock to the team. What are your thoughts on what Descalso and Brock can bring to the table this year?
Well, I think Descalso gives you a real good left-handed bat off the bench after the move of Tommy La Stella to the Angels. You really needed to have a good bat you could count on coming off the bench to get on base. He's versatile defensively, can kind of play all over the place, and he brings that leadership quality that you can never have enough of, for sure. Brad Brock, I think, is a nice addition to the bullpen. As we look around baseball, every team has quality and quantity. And I think, closing experience definitely helps. You can never have enough guys who've been able to get the final three outs. And again, with Brandon Morrow's status, I just think you have to do everything you can to cover that. And even if Morrow were healthy, I think the Cubs would have gone out and done the Brock deal. And they may not be done. They may have another bullpen arm that they want to bring in to the mix, maybe even a possible starting candidate who could either be with the Cubs at the beginning of the year, maybe a AAA. I think some things have to be sorted out that way. But in terms of the nucleus and the everyday part of the roster, that's pretty much set.
Is there anyone specific that comes to mind in regards to who the Cubs could still sign before the season begins?
It's really hard to tell. There are a lot of players available. Again, I think if you need anything to add, it's probably another arm or two. In terms of the rest of the roster, it looks pretty set, but I think you're always searching and looking for a bargain, a value. There may be someone you had your eye on in terms of free agency who wanted a little bit more than you could spend. And as we get closer to spring training, possibly the cost or the price could come down. So you're always looking, but I'd be surprised if there's a big ticket player out there the Cubs end up grabbing.
With the exception of all these smaller signings, the Cubs haven't really been as active this offseason in comparison to the past. This was a year in which there was lots of talk about the Cubs and Bryce Harper possibly being a fit. Why do you think the Cubs have been so quiet this offseason, with the exception of some of these smaller signings? What do you think the reasoning is behind that?
Well, I think there are a lot of reasons why the Cubs are where they are in terms of their payroll is one of the highest in baseball. As you get into arbitration years with all their young star players, they all take up more of the payroll as time moves on. They spent a lot of money the last offseason in bringing in the pitching that we just talked about. And, essentially, as Theo Epstein said at the Cubs convention, he's always had a budget. He's always had payroll flexibility.
So that was my interview with Len Kasper, and right now, it's now time for our special guest. He began his broadcasting career right here at the University of Chicago, calling basketball games for WHBK, while during the spring, playing baseball for the Maroons. After college, he became the voice of Loyola University basketball and continued to develop his baseball coaching career. Following stops at IIT, Notre Dame, and North Central College, he's now the baseball head coach here at UChicago, while serving as the lead voice of Maroon Athletics. Please welcome Coach John Fitzgerald to the show. Coach, very nice to have you on the show today. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for having me, John. Nice to be back on WHBK.
Exactly. Very nice. It's like a homecoming for you.
Absolutely.
Well, to start today, Coach Fitz, let's take a quick look at the Maroons basketball team, starting with the men's team, because right now they're in the thick of a conference championship battle. They're trying to fend off WashU and Emory. What have been your impressions on UChicago's season thus far? Obviously, you've watched them all their home games, broadcasting. What are your impressions on their season, and also, do you have faith in them catching up to WashU and Emory?
Well, yeah, I absolutely do have faith in them. Whether or not I'm intelligent enough to decipher what the other teams in the race do is a whole other story. You know, it's a talented group. It's probably as talented a group top to bottom that I think that Mike McGrath has had in recent times. They got a number of weapons, and at times have all shown that numerous players in this ball club can kind of carry the ball club either for stretches during a game or entire games on their back. So I think that makes them incredibly dangerous. The real determining factor is really the last 2.5, I guess, 3 weekends that they're going to deal with in conference play. And the one that they've got coming up, beginning at Rochester and then down to Emory, I believe, this coming weekend, you know, that's a really tough trip for anybody. I mean, Emory and Rochester on the men's side had a difficult trip here earlier in the conference slate and lost both games to Chicago. As a matter of fact, I think Rochester was swept, losing at Wash U as well. And that was a Rochester team that was undefeated going into that weekend. But, I mean, you're talking about 3 flights, not only out to your initial destination, a flight and a day off in between, and then a late flight coming home. When you throw in midterms, they throw in classes. That's a really difficult trip. Now for the men, I mean, right now they're in a tie for second, third place, depending upon how you look at it. Emory and Wash U both entering play this weekend at 7-2 in conference play, then Rochester and Chicago a game back at 6-3. But, I mean, 2 of those 3 teams that are theoretically ahead of them in the standings, they're both going to go head-to-head with this weekend. So the opportunity is beyond all shadow of a doubt there. It's really how are they going to be able to deal with the travel factor? How are they going to be able to deal with all the other variables that go into that?
And it's interesting because for a team that went 13-12 last season, they made little to no impact in conference play. This year, it's quite the opposite. I mean, they're in the conference race. They've had a great record so far. How do you think some of these holdover players like Jordan Baum, Noah Karras, Dominic Larrivee are going to perform under this added pressure of a legitimate conference run?
I think with everything else that we've seen already this year, I think it would be distinctly a positive aspect for them. And I think the main reason for that is the maturation process. I mean, 500 team last year overall, just over 500. But the maturation process that takes place, in particular during any year between 18 and 21, when you're talking about college basketball, when you're talking about getting reps, when you're talking about kind of being in the fire of some of these conference contests and the traveling involved as well. I mean, they're battle-tested from that standpoint, and I think that showed in not only their individual performances but collectively as a team this year and how they've performed, that this is just a more of a veteran ball club. I mean, Dominic Larrivee has made huge strides from a year ago, not only from a point standpoint but a minute standpoint, kind of what he has given to this team. Cole Schmitz has been as hot as anybody, I think, in the league over probably the last 4 or 5 weeks now since the start of conference play. But Baum has been an outstanding distributor of the basketball. We've seen over the last couple of weeks that he can light up the scoreboard and become awfully red hot to carry this ball club. Karras is one of the best shooters from outside. So they have so many weapons, but I think the thing that they've got in their back pocket right now is they've all done this before. This isn't a ball club where they're rolling out 3 freshman starters or 5 guys in their 10-man rotation that are freshmen or barely have played. These guys have done that a little bit more, and I think that's going to pay dividends for them down the stretch over these last 3 weeks.
Coach John Fitzgerald here on Sports Talk Chicago. And Coach Fitz, moving to the women's team, they're currently ranked inside the D3 Top 25 poll, and once again, they're making another conference title run as they attempt to reach Wash U. Now, for a team that went 24-3 last season, undefeated in conference, what are your thoughts on their comparison last year versus this year?
You know, they had a lot of people back, and I think it's real easy to say, well, they should be doing the exact same thing. It should be a total carbon copy. And I just don't think that's the case, due in large part to the fact that you are literally playing with a target on your back right now. And they had some great wins in the non-conference portion, but I mean, this is a grind of a conference play. And it's a grind not only because of the travel involved, because of it's not your typical Wednesday, Saturday conference play where you've got kind of day of rest, a day of prep, and then you're going. You're in a hotel. You're switching hotels. You're prepping on the fly for the next date while you're trying to nurse some injuries and possibly playing in less than 36 hours from the final buzzer on a Friday night to the opening tip on Sunday. So that part adds up a little bit, I think. And they're also playing as a nationally ranked team where this is everybody's biggest game in a conference that, you know, on both the men's and the women's side, top to bottom, the parity has been phenomenal. I know NYU has really struggled this year on the men's side. But generally speaking, this is a very, very good conference, top to bottom. So you're not going to be able to just kind of roll out the basketballs, get by, and get an automatic W in this league, whether or not you're home or on the road. So that part has been difficult to overcome, and I think sometimes when you're getting the best game out of everybody every time that the ball goes up in the air, that's a taxing endeavor, both mentally and physically, for a ball club. So, I mean, I think they've stubbed their toe a couple of times. It's an immensely talented ball club. I think that their defense will provide not only offense, but I think the results they want down the stretch. They're obviously going to have what really is the makings to be a matchup for all the marbles, depending upon how things play out over the next 2 weekends, with Wash U to close out the regular season, with that automatic bid very well potentially on the line down in St. Louis on that afternoon. But it's a ball club that's obscenely well prepped. I think the coaching staff does a phenomenal job being able to pick apart opponents in pregame schemes, and that has shown. They've had some off nights, obviously, offensively, where shots have not fallen. But again, it's a veteran group, and I would rather go to battle down the stretch with a lot of meaning on the final games with some players who have been there before. And they have that.
As you mentioned, players being there before, and this team last year, you know, they made it to the second round of the NCAA tournament. So comparing last year to this year, do you see them, number one, making the tournament again, and how far do you see them going with this current roster?
So hard to tell, and I will be the first to admit to you, I did not see them with any regularity last year, aside from highlights, reading stats, stuff like that. So it's a little bit difficult for me to make an apples-to-apples comparison from that standpoint. You know, I think when you get into single elimination tournaments, a lot of crazy stuff can happen. I think this is most definitely a tournament-caliber ball club. Whether or not they win the league and get the automatic bid, they're deserving. If they don't, how everything else shakes out with regard to the region, with regard to upsets in other conference tournaments where the regular season champion does not win the automatic bid, but they're going to take up an at-large bid. There's a lot of chess play that goes involved in that, the final 24 to 48 hours on that selection weekend where they're trying to fit oftentimes square pegs into round holes, and it makes it very difficult. So the non-conference portion that they played from a schedule standpoint, winning at Illinois Wesleyan, and some of the teams they played, Thomas Moore being on their schedule, that will help beyond all shadow of a doubt because she has played a very difficult schedule, as Chris is saying. Just a matter of really, I think, how they finish the stretch of the regular season and whether or not they're lucky enough to get a bid. But, I mean, unfortunately, the only way that all variables are removed from the situation is to win the automatic bid and win the regular season title. And, you know, they're going to need a little bit of help to do that because they're 2 games back with 5 to play right now.
I wanted to now shift gears to some baseball. You'll be entering your 5th season at the helm here at UChicago in 2019. And last season, you guys posted the best record under your tenure at 26-13. What are you expecting out of your team this season after last year's success?
Probably, to be honest with you, I would expect us to be successful again. I think that our schedule has significantly been ramped up, I think, from a strength of schedule standpoint this coming year. We have a lot of brand new pieces who I think are going to be immediate impact players for us in the program and over the next 4 years. There's going to be an adjustment period for some of those guys. There were for some of our freshmen last year, and there was a much smaller one for some of our freshmen last year who played immediately for us, and obviously we yielded some pretty good results last year. It's going to be an interesting year. You know, this is a program that probably over its 100-plus years of history has never really been in a conference aside from, I think, a 4 or 5 year stint as members of the Midwest Conference back in the late 1970s and the early 80s, prior to the UAA, at which point they didn't really play in a regular season conference format. So we, like football, are going into the Midwest Conference this year. So we now have the opportunity, unlike in any other year past that I've been associated with this program, to play for a regular season title, get into a conference tournament, and play for an automatic bid to the NCAA tournament, which has never been done here before. And this really is the first time, at least in very recent memory, that the program has had at least a seat at the table to be able to do that. So that's changed our energy level, I think, a little bit this year. You know, there were many years in years past with my predecessor, Brian Baldea, who was here for 25 years, that if you really don't go 10-1 in your spring trip, you can pretty much kiss away any postseason possibility. And that's a really, really difficult window to play a 40-game schedule in, when if you get off to a slow start due to injury, due to playing difficult teams right out of the chute who might have been outside a lot earlier than you, to not being able to judge a fly ball because you've been inside for the last 3 months. When you're 6-6, 6-4, 7-3 even, and you're coming back knowing that there is no way, unless you run the table, that you're going to go to the NCAA tournament, that, you know, that's difficult from a motivating factor for guys, I think. And now really for the first time being able to be part of the proverbial pennant chase that everybody talks about in baseball, to be able to play in a conference tournament, be able to play your way into the NCAA tournament for the first time ever, I think that is really going to have the opportunity to change the dynamic of our program. But I obviously hope going in every year it's going to be a successful season. You're always an injury or two with the wrong position away from not being as successful as you want. But I think the personnel we have now and have started to have over the last couple of years has really been able to turn the corner for this program for us.
So with you being excited about you guys being able to play in the NCAA tournament, how likely do you think it is for you guys this year specifically to make it there, considering last year's success?
Difficult question. Difficult question because of the fact that we're going into a league that, aside from a few teams that we would play here and there, I don't know much about. It's going to be a little bit more of a mental and physical drain, I think, on our guys, because our weekends now in conference play are going to be 4 9-inning games over 2 days. So you're talking about, obviously, need for more solid arms, 36 innings you got to get through on the weekend. One catcher is really not going to be able to do it. Maybe you could do a 3-game series, which we've typically done. Now we're going to 4, need a second catcher. Need to rest some guys midweek a little bit because they're going to have sore arms or they're going to get hit by a pitch and be out for a couple days. So it's going to be a much more of a collective effort this year than it's ever had to be in the past. And guys will have to step up. We're going to have to be deeper, and we're going to have to perform at a deeper level than just the 9 guys in our starting rotation that we run out there. Games are going to be won and lost with, you know, the 12th pitcher possibly who's throwing on that weekend, who's going to either close out or keep us in a game that's incredibly important based upon the conference race on Sunday at 5:30 in the afternoon. And it's going to be a totally different dynamic for us. So it's going to be interesting to see. Talent level wise, I would say we're going to be right there with them. It's how we kind of adjust to that and how quickly we really adjust to the format and the ability to kind of string together 36 good innings over a 2-day span on the weekends. It's going to be incredibly important, both mentally and physically, I think.
going back to your baseball career for a moment, I know you pitched for the Maroons for 4 years. You posted a 12-8 record. So tell me about your experience playing here in college in comparison to now coaching UChicago baseball. And as a follow-up, how surreal is it for you to now be coaching at your alma mater?
We can talk about the second part a lot more. The playing career wasn't all that memorable. I had a great experience here. I played for an individual, Brian Baldea, who I mentioned earlier, who was here for 25 years, both as a baseball coach and associate athletic director, who unfortunately passed away last winter. True mentor, professionally became a very, very good friend since I've been into coaching. So the opportunity to come back and follow him was incredibly intriguing, obviously. There's really not a whole lot of comparison between the baseball and Chicago as I knew it back toward the 2000 year and now when I came back. I mean, this place has physically changed significantly. I mean, our field is in the same spot. Henry Crown Fieldhouse still exists, but the dynamic of this campus, not only I think how it's physically grown, but I think the undergraduate population, what the offerings are, is so significantly better than it was when I was here. And I had a phenomenal experience here. I thoroughly enjoyed my time here. We're successful on the field. It was a great 4 years from a baseball program standpoint. I had been away for a while, to be perfectly honest with you. I mean, we would always play Chicago. I kind of come in. We'd play as a road team when I was at North Central or back when I was at Illinois Tech, and then kind of take off and never really went through campus until kind of came back for an interview and over the first couple months that I was back here in this position. But it is surreal from that standpoint, but it's kind of more of an honor in my mind to be able to follow somebody who I thought so highly of and who meant so much to me, both professionally and personally, to kind of be able to take up where he left off and kind of guide this program. But it is surreal at times. You find yourself thinking, yeah, I remember when, and it was just across the street from here. Also makes you feel incredibly old very, very often, which I prefer not to think too often about, but unfortunately I do think that's the case. But it's a really neat experience to be able to come back to a place that you have such an affinity for and always have, and now be the baseball coach. And to be perfectly honest with you, I don't know since I've been here that I've really sat back to think too much about that, but it really is an honor when I really think about the opportunity to be the baseball coach at this institution.
A few more minutes here with Coach John Fitzgerald, head baseball coach here at the University of Chicago. And Coach Fitch, I wanted to move now to your broadcasting career and hear about your journey in the business, because you started right here on WHBK. Now that you're the lead voice of UChicago Athletics, how have you gotten to where you are today? Describe your journey to how you've gotten here.
Well, I think you could say I took a bit of a circular route, because I'm right back where I was 20 years ago, which probably isn't the best professional move. Things have worked out well from that standpoint. It's been different. It's something I kind of fell into when I was here as an undergraduate. Started doing basketball games when I was here. Ended up going to grad school at Loyola University, and as I got my MBA, was working in their athletic department. Ended up somehow elevating, becoming the director of marketing, corporate sponsorships, and broadcasting at Loyola, where for a couple of years I was, in addition to those sales duties and marketing duties, I was the play-by-play voice for Loyola basketball on radio and television. Did that for a couple of years. Took a sports director job down at Illinois State University, down at a radio station in Central Illinois, who had the rights to Illinois State University, and WJBC in Bloomington Normal. Did morning sports on the news talk station. Got up at 4 every morning. Did football and Illinois State men's basketball along with the coaches' shows, and enjoyed my time there mentally. It was a great situation. I mean, the people that had gone through there prior to me was immense, which was one of the really attractive things about taking that job was Jim Durham, the former voice of the Bulls and ESPN Radio, was there. Brickhouse was there at one point, even further back. The person I replaced was a man by the name of Mark Johnson, who had left to go to Syracuse to be the play-by-play man of the Orange and is now, I think, been with Colorado Buffaloes for probably at least 10 years now. So they really had a great lineage of broadcasters in play-by-play who had gone through there, so it was attractive. But at the end of the basketball season, I was coaching high school baseball down there, and I still remember the owner of the station coming through, and there was our contract was up as the rights holder for Illinois State football and basketball, and they said, you know, forget it, we're not going to pay any more for this. We'll just do high school sports. And I'm thinking to myself, I don't really want to be living down here and just doing high school sports. I wanted to be doing Division I play-by-play. So at one point, the athletic department at Illinois State had reached out and said, we'll bring you over here full-time in the athletic department, do a job similar to what you did at Loyola, be it marketing, be it sales, and you'll stay as a play-by-play guy. And I said, great, that'd be perfect. I like it down here. And I liked it at the radio station, too. Don't get me wrong. It was a great situation. But unfortunately back then, which I didn't even realize was in my contract, I had something called a no-compete clause, which meant that even if the rights to the station in Illinois State changed, because I was employed by the station, I was not going to be able to appear on the air within like 100 miles of Bloomington Normal, which would, in essence, mean I couldn't do Illinois State basketball anymore, regardless of what station they ended up at, basketball or football. So that pretty much forced my move into this might not be a great situation long term. And I ended up going into coaching, had an opportunity to go up to Chicago, became the head baseball coach at Illinois Tech, and then kind of from a broadcasting standpoint, did the TV package on Fox Sports, Sports Channel Chicago, take your pick of what it was called at that point for Loyola for a few years and did some fill-in stuff. I was an anchor. I was a part-time host over at Sporting News Radio Network, which was at that point syndicated up in the northern suburbs. And then the person who replaced me at Loyola on radio, Andy Mazur, had at that point left to go be the Padres on their broadcast crew for radio out in San Diego. So he moved to San Diego. I went back into Loyola, and I probably stayed about 10, 12 years or so until my position was kind of eliminated about 2 years ago over there. So my first couple of years here at Chicago, I was still doing the radio and TV for Loyola before they eliminated it, which unfortunately was, you know, after a lot of years on buses in both the Horizon League and the Valley with teams that that were good but not great, didn't have the opportunity to do the Final Four run for them.
Well, Coach Fitz, thank you so much for being here on the show. I came right to 10 o'clock, which is perfect. Great story, and really hope to have you on again in the future. Thank you for your insight and your time.
Sounds great, John. Thanks so much for having me.
There it is, Coach John Fitzgerald right here on the show. That took us right to 10 o'clock, actually, which is perfect timing. Unfortunately, I wanted to talk about the Bulls. We couldn't get to it. But nevertheless, really fun, really insightful interview with him. Got to delve into his past a bit, talk about his coaching career. Really fun time talking with him. And if you're wondering, you can listen to him and myself also broadcast UChicago basketball. I broadcast with him usually the Sunday afternoon slate, and he broadcasts both Friday night and Sunday night. So make sure to check that out. Coach John Fitzgerald, UChicago baseball. Well, it's now 10 o'clock. That'll do it for us today. Great show today as we talked about the Super Bowl NFL Awards and had a very special guest on and Coach John Fitzgerald. Make sure to join us next week, 9 a.m. for more Chicago Sports Talk. And also, find my podcast, SportsTalkChicago.com. I just uploaded one this morning with Thomas Jones, former NFL running back, former Bears star. We talked about his new movie coming out, some Chicago Bears news, the recap of the 2018 season, and so much more. I'd like to thank the University of Chicago, Coach Fitz, for coming here on the show and WHBK. And we'll sign off with music today by TMMRG.